Welcome to Hellbent. This is a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Varsha.
And I'm Devin. And today on the pod, we are going to talk about this immigration and ICE hot mess, which is just the very beginning of that discussion. We're also going to talk about North Korea and what is going on there and the very strange turn of events that it's taken. And strange is the nicest thing that I can say about it. And we also are going to get into a little bit of ZTE and China. It's very confusing.
There's a lot of players there. There's such as ZTE, this telecommunications company. There's also Ivanka. There's also her dad. There's also corruption and crime. The usual stuff.
Surprise. Corruption and crime. I'm also very excited to announce, Varsha, you're here with me in the studio.
I'm in the studio. I'm very excited.
It's so cool. This is the first time we've actually met in person. Yes. And you're in town because your sister is graduating?
Yep. My sister's graduating high school tomorrow, actually.
That's awesome. So we're so excited that you're here. Did you do anything fun for the long weekend?
Not really. I mostly just stayed at home and like did some research and stuff.
Yeah. That's honestly sometimes all you need, though. Like just a lazy weekend.
So, Devin, was there any listener feedback for the last couple episodes?
Yes. So, first, I want to say that, well, first of all, everyone loves you, Varsha. I've gotten so much positive feedback about you being the guest host. And, you know, like I said on Thursday, everyone from Twitter and Facebook and my husband were like, yep, this is it. This is the person that needs to stay. So, I just want to say that we love having you. And then I also got a lot of feedback to the interview I did on Thursday. And this was always going to be an issue that is complicated. So we talked about what had happened in Gaza and the protests with the U.S. moving the Israeli embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So this interview I did with actually a friend of mine, Rabbi Jacqueline Cohen, and I was really looking to her to get a perspective on the American Jews' connection to Israel. Again, I'm not Jewish. I don't have any connection personally to Israel. So it was hard for me to understand why people were coming to the defense of a place that they don't, that is not their homeland, right?
That's why I liked the interview as well. It was really good to see her perspective, especially like the last couple of questions you asked her. It was like, is there a line Israel can cross, you know? And so it was good to get inside somebody else's shoes and how they view Israel and why it's important to them.
Right. But what I will say is that there were definitely things we did not talk about during that interview that are important to this discussion. And I mentioned very briefly on Thursday, but I'm actually talking to a journalist who's covering what was going on over there who would give a slightly different perspective. And I'm hoping to get them on the show for this week. But even without two different interviews, you know, we got one piece of negative feedback from @Lazen by Knees. They said, quote, I was truly sickened by this discussion as much as the Schneiderman episode. Not only were, quote, settlements not mentioned once in the discussion of the West Bank, not only was there falsely ascribed a border around Gaza, but Devin said that she, quote, liked the analogy of Palestinians to toddlers and the constant invoking of family to justify settler colonial apartheid just isn't a good look anymore. I'm sorry. And she linked to a BuzzFeed article about the New York Times Arrested Development story, you know, the sort of like family. And so that was definitely a great point. And what I will say is that the toddler metaphor was not a good one.
And there was a disclaimer at the beginning of the episode, but like not to excuse the metaphor, but there was a disclaimer at the beginning of the episode. But also when it comes to that issue of family, like I totally understand where this person is coming from. It's how people have described oppression in a colonial concept for like a long time,
right?
British Empire,
right?
Other types of empire, and it is problematic. And so like I understood where that was coming from when I was listening to the discussion, but I do think that, you know, you and Jacqueline Cohen like did a good job like explaining that even though it's a reductive metaphor, fundamentally the issue is that there's two sides that can't understand when other person is talking,
right?
And I think where this person's coming from is that she got frustrated because she thought Palestinians were the only person being referred to as toddlers. And again, I'm not a fan of the metaphor, but I do think that there is truth to the notion that both sides, the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, are at a point where they don't understand how to discuss a fundamental issue.
Right. And I think that, honestly, the toddler metaphor was reductive and insulting, honestly. It's an insulting metaphor. And it's something we've talked about with calling Trump like a child or a toddler, and how that's definitely problematic. And it was not the right way to put it. What I think Jacqueline was getting at was that we have come to a stalwart in its most basic terms. It's two sides, two people that cannot communicate.
Yeah, I actually saw, again, this might be another reductive example, but I was looking through a bunch of old books. My mom wants to get rid of them. And I used to save the political cartoons from Newsweek back in like 2009. And there's a political cartoon in 2009 where it has a picture of the last Israeli, the last Palestinian, and the first like, square. And then in the next square is like they're both running at each other and fighting. And that's from 2009.
Right.
And that's almost, 8 years ago, 9 years ago, and we still have this issue. And again, that's not to say that there's an easy solution out there.
Right.
That's just saying is what people in America are viewing is that they're at a stalemate and they can't discuss an issue.
Right.
But again, all of these like criticisms with the way it was phrased are totally fair.
Absolutely. And we didn't talk about settlements and we didn't dig into the deep political oppression and the roots there. And again, that was an editorial choice and maybe not the right one, but definitely something missing from that conversation. And Jacqueline actually reached out to me. She wanted to shout out to the group that she'd been talking about, the Muslim Jewish Dialogue Group. And she wanted to let everyone know that it was called New Ground, a Muslim Jewish partnership for change, if anyone would like to check them out. And she really likes them. And so I just wanted to make sure that we could throw that out there. So, I'm not sure about how we're going to continue this discussion. And it's really going to depend on if I can get the second interview, if we're going to continue this. But, it is such an important issue. And like I said, I've never had super firm opinions. I've never really understood it. And it's something that I'm trying to enlighten myself to. And I appreciate the sort of discussion that we're having.
Yeah, it's the same thing for me because I have a few friends who are Israeli. I have a few friends who are Jewish. And so they give me a certain perspective on what it means to have a settlement, what Netanyahu means to the country, et cetera. But then I also have a lot of friends who are, support the Palestinian side. And they give me a certain view of what it means, what the settlements actually mean, what they mean to the community there. And so it's a very difficult issue. And I think it's hard to come down on one side in even a podcast, even an article, whatever. It takes like a couple months to actually digest this whole issue.
Right.
Just like anything else. It's not a simple political problem, because if it was, then Jared Kushner would have solved the issue already.
It is in his portfolio of shit to do. I also want to take a moment to recognize that yesterday was Memorial Day. We didn't do a show. It was a holiday. And we would like to honor all of those who have made the ultimate sacrifice for our country and our freedom. If you're like me, the list of books you want to read or that people suggest you read is never ending and always expanding. You simply don't have time to read them all. I don't have time to read them all. Our sponsor, Blinkist, has solved your long list of must-reads once and for all. Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most impactful elements so you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes, all on your phone. And with Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge and learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anywhere. I've started listening to Blinkist while I do the dishes, and I hate doing the dishes, but lately I've actually been excited for the 15 minutes of relative silence I can use to catch up on the books that I'm still lying to myself about sitting down to read. The Blinkist library is massive, from timeless classics like Think and Grow Rich to current bestsellers like Fire and Fury. This is really great for those of us into politics. Taking the essential ideas from these nonfiction books and using them to really get our brains tingling gives us more power in the political space. I recently listened to The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, which is a book that's been sitting on my Kindle for months. And getting that quick 15-minute digest made the dishes go faster and made me really think. Blinkist is constantly curating and adding new titles from best of lists, so you're always getting the most powerful ideas in a made-for-mobile format. 5 million people are using Blinkist to expand their minds 15 minutes at a time, so get started today. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for Hellions. Go to Blinkist.com/hellbent to start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan when you join today. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/hellbent to start your free trial or get 3 months off of your yearly plan. Blinkist.com/hellbent. All right, Varsha, let's get into our first news block. We're going to talk about ICE and immigration, and there's a lot that's been coming up. And some of it's new information, some of it's old information, and there seems to be two different aspects to this story. So let's try to parse those out a little bit. Can you kind of tell us what's going on?
Definitely. So there's two issues, and they involve two separate agencies of the federal government. The first issue is that Health and Human Services, HHS, doesn't know or lost track of 1,500 unaccompanied minors. And this was in 2014, and it came out in a report in 2016 in a Senate hearing. And basically that means that when unaccompanied minors cross the border, they're placed either with immediate family members, other guardians, or eventually in a shelter. But if they're placed with immediate family members or guardians, sometimes HHS loses track of them. Just like I saw a great thread online, is like a former prison warden loses track of people who like leave the prison and serve their time. Same thing with unaccompanied minors. And that's why, you know, this story has blown up, because at the same time, a new policy has been in place under the Trump administration, which is not a policy under Obama, Bush, Clinton, or any other president I can remember, which is ICE is separating parents from children at the border. And so ICE is a separate government agency under DHS. And basically, Immigration and Customs Enforcement is when a parent and a child come to the border to either seek asylum, which is legal, or cross the border and become undocumented immigrants. They're separating children at the border. And this is a barbaric, inhumane practice. And the thing is, when somebody, I don't know where this story started on Twitter, but when somebody posted the story about the 1,500 unaccompanied minors, people started conflating the two issues.
Right. Which, okay, both stories are about children. Exactly. At their core as they cross the border. So I can understand where the conflation comes
from. It comes from a good place. Right. And it wasn't like anything malicious. Nobody was trying to spread any false stories. It was just real concern, because when you see a headline that says HHS has lost track of 1,475 unaccompanied minors, and they might be in the hands of human traffickers, people start to lose their minds.
Right. So that was where this story really came from, is that there were 30,000 pages of documents obtained through a records request. And in these documents, they found that there were detailed accusations of physical and mental abuse at the hands of officers, this is according to Newsweek. And that some of these unaccompanied minors, when they were released from HHS, wound up in the hands of traffickers. And so basically this report is alleging that, or the committee investigating this report is alleging that HHS failed to protect these minors from traffickers and other abusers. So that is a big story, right? Now, whether or not you lose track of them and whether where they end up, I mean, this is something that the government is tasked to do. And we're going to get into why, like, we don't maybe need HHS to track all of the unaccompanied minors that they release into guardians. But this is a huge hole in what the government is supposed to do. Again, I talked to Aditi about this a couple of times. Just because something is a law doesn't make it right. Just because something is right doesn't make it a law. And so, but this is a hole in what HHS is supposed to be doing. They are supposed to be keeping track of these unaccompanied minors. They are not doing so. And in at least 10 trafficking victims were found to be unaccompanied minors.
Yeah. And that was based on like a Frontline piece. And there was also something by the ACLU, and they're the ones who got a hold of like this document as a records request. Basically, it alleges abuse by CPB, Customs and Border Protection. So there are like so many different levels of abuse that's happening towards unaccompanied minors. There's so many levels of where they are in danger from. So they're in danger from people who are helping them cut across the border. They're in danger from human traffickers. And they're also sometimes in danger from our own federal government. And so that's why people were so, so furious this past weekend. Because when you compound all of this past abuse in 2014, which was again under a previous administration, with the current policy, which is separating children from their parents, it's a lot to take in.
Right. And also one thing we're going to get into in just a second, but when you separate children from their parents, they then become registered as unaccompanied minors. So this is becomes a cyclical problem, right? Where we are tracking unaccompanied minors, we're losing track of them, and then then children become unaccompanied minors because they're separated from their parents at the border. So to explain some of this, because the basic story is between October and December 2017, almost 1,500 out of about 7,500 minors that ORR, which is the Office of Refugee Resettlement, tried to reach, they couldn't find them. So that's about 19%. So there's this epic Twitter thread by Josie Rice.
Well, and basically she wanted everyone to stop conflating the two issues.
Right. So I'm going to read the whole thing. It's long. Please stick with me. But it really does a great job of teasing out these two stories. So she said, quote, there are two things going on. One, HHS doesn't know where 1,500 unaccompanied minors are. Two, we are separating parents and children at the border. These are different. The kids in one were not separated from their parents at the border. They crossed the border alien or arrived here without a parent. These kids were dealt with by ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement. They were released to the care of people that almost always fit within one of these three categories. One, immediate family. Two, extended family. Three, other people that the child has a pre-existing relationship with. If none of these categories apply, then the kids normally stay in a shelter. After a number of children were trafficked in 2014, these restrictions got tighter. So this goes back to the original documents request, where they found that a few of these minors had been released into the hands of traffickers. And so now they're saying that unless the child has a pre-existing relationship with this person, they've tightened those restrictions so that doesn't happen again. Okay, continuing. So those kids are released and then they are no longer ORR's responsibility or problem. This is a good thing. One analogy I heard from a dear friend who I won't tag without her permission is that ORR is basically a jailer. Do you want the jail keeping track of where every former inmate is? Now I have more to say about that, but before I do that, let's talk about the word missing. Basically, by all accounts, HHS did a cursory reach out to check on these kids and couldn't find out where they were exactly. When I say cursory, I mean cursory. We're talking about phone calls. Phone calls, like no door knocks, no checking school records. They called. They didn't find answers. There are so many reasons people wouldn't answer. Maybe these kids are living with someone undocumented. Maybe they aren't, but their sponsor is legitimately completely scared of immigration authorities in Trump's America. They aren't missing. They are almost certainly living with a family member who almost certainly didn't want to interact with the government, and we shouldn't ask them to. ORR's job is not to track and monitor these kids, and it shouldn't be. As my friend said, if there were an issue, abuse or other wrongdoing, and it should go through the appropriate agency. Children's services or what have you. It shouldn't go through HHS/ORR or DHS ICE. Now, I started out identifying two things that were happening. The second, the separation of children and their parents at the border, is goddamn unconscionable and sickening. One, ORR has exclusive jurisdiction over unaccompanied minors, UACs, and they are not under ICE's jurisdiction. ICE may apprehend them, but they are given to ORR. Two, ORR is under Health and Human Services, not Department of Homeland Security, because the idea is that UACs, unaccompanied minors, are a vulnerable population and we don't want them under ICE's purview because, as we know, ICE is full of evil people. Cosine. Three, traditionally, information given to ORR was not shared with ICE because authorities realized that these kids would never be able to get a sponsor. 90% of the time, the sponsor is a family member if ORR threatened that person with deportation. But that's been changing under Trump, as I'm sure no one is surprised to know. And now, as of May 13th, ICE and ORR are working together officially now. The government released a memorandum of agreement about it. All right. That's a lot. It's a lot to unpack.
And basically, I mean, the core issue is that what Josie is saying is that HHS doesn't have to know where these 1,500 unaccompanied minors are, and they didn't look hard enough. But also, they don't have to look hard enough because there is a good chance that most of them are living with family members and are completely fine. But there was an issue in 2014 where a few of them were released into traffickers or were abused by CPB itself, and that's why restrictions got tighter. But again, that issue in 2014 is still a problem. Like, it's definitely a big issue, and it's horrible that our government was a part of it, but it's not the same thing as what's happening today.
Exactly. So I think the real takeaway from here and the real important issue here is that now, as of the mid-May, ICE and ORR are working together, and that's not something we wanted.
That is not something you want, because right. If that happens, what that's saying is that ORR is either giving information to ICE or ICE is giving information to ORR, and they're either preventing refugee resettlement or they are encouraging deportation. Right. So they're basically sharing information to execute the administration's agenda, and the administration's agenda is to terrorize immigrants.
Right. I would also like to take this moment to point out that we have talked about ORR before, the Office of Refugee Resettlement. That is because back in October of 2017, there was a Jane Doe who was trying to get a legal abortion, and ORR was blocking her right to do so.
And they've done so with other undocumented minors as well.
Right, exactly. So the head of ORR, noted mega dickwad Scott Lloyd, has actually been personally involved in stopping legal abortions in undocumented minors in the care of ORR. So we know that ORR is not exactly here to be a benevolent, like, role in these kids' lives. So the fact that they're not keeping track of everyone is probably a good thing. And so now what we know from this, though, is that now that ORR is working with ICE, especially when you put it in context of Scott Lloyd and the abortion case, the Jane Doe abortion case in October, there's getting this really softening of these defined roles. And I think that's the issue. And there's these two stories that are very confusing. But when you look at them together and zoom out a little bit, you see that the real story here is that this government is using these two agencies to, like you said, Varsha, execute their immigration policy. So let's talk about that. We talked a lot about those 1,500 quote unquote missing undocumented children. But now let's talk about an actual sickening problem, which is that the US's policy is now to separate children from their parents at the border. So for months, members of Congress, this is according to New York Times, have been demanding answers about how many families are being separated as they, quote, are processed at stations along the southwest border, in part because the Trump administration has in the past said it was considering taking children from their parents as a way to deter migrants from coming here. And back in the beginning of May, end of April, Jeff Sessions actually went on record and said, this is now the policy. We don't want to separate families. But we absolutely will. That's the new policy.
There's no tolerance policy, and we will separate every single family we see at the border. And Kirstjen Nielsen was at a hearing a few weeks ago, or maybe it was a month ago, and Senator Harris was asking her questions. And basically, Nielsen, who's the head of DHS, was like, the reason that we're doing this is because it is best for the children, which I don't think is true. Because when you're separating parents, like a child who's literally either most of them are under four. So they, yeah, well, the New York Times shows that more than 700 children have been taken from adults claiming to be their parents since October 2017. And more than 100 of those children, not most of them, but 100 of those children were under the age of four. So when you separate a child who's under four, who's probably the only person, the only adult they trust is their parent, that's going to be traumatic. And so I don't see that as the best interest of the child.
Again, I feel like this is the theme recently, but the level of dehumanization you need to get to then be able to tell yourself that it's in the interest of a four-year-old to take them away from their parents is unfathomable to me. It's unfathomable.
And I just wanted to add something. As we remember, dickwad of last Monday was Donald Trump, and that was because he was making comments supposedly about MS-13 being, right, quote-unquote animals. But since then, he has said these minors that are coming across the border, not all of them are innocent. And he didn't call them animals, but the administration doubled down with a release about what you need to know about these MS-13 animals. And then Donald Trump, a couple days later, said unaccompanied minors might not all be innocent. So that's how this kind of dehumanization works. You choose a specific subset of people that you can claim are definitely criminals, aka in this case is MS-13, and then you extrapolate and expand that group. And that's what's happening, because John Kelly, who is the chief of staff, when he gave an interview, I think it was a few weeks ago, May 11th NPR interview, John Kelly was like, quote, the children will be taken care of, put into foster care or whatever.
Okay, whatever is not a word that should ever be used when talking about children, period.
That doesn't really inspire confidence.
No.
In John Kelly's ability to care for children.
No.
Well,
here's the other issue. Is again, we kind of go in this like circular issue, as they all come back to these few core problems. Is that once these unaccompanied minors or children separated from their parents who are then identified as unaccompanied minors go into the system, they look for someone to take them. And if they can't find someone, especially with these tightenings of restrictions, rightfully, so that they don't get into the hands of traffickers, if they can't find a sponsor or a family member for the children, they can just sit in custody indefinitely in these shelters. And once they are in custody like this, according to the New York Times, there's no firm process to figure out who they've been separated for or plans for reunification. So it's not like they're like, oh, we're going to separate you, figure this out, reunify you, figure what out to do from there. There's no process like that. And so when John Kelly says, or whatever, the or whatever is taking children into custody and leaving them there and not doing anything and no plans for reunification. And I just can't understand how people like Kristen Nielsen, who are defending this practice. It's absolutely sickening. It's also a big old gaslighting tool, right? Like we're really obfuscating what's really going on here.
Yeah, and we're basically what Nielsen is trying to put this veneer of care around this issue. But what she's doing by saying that this is the best interest of the child is she's saying that anybody who tries to seek asylum or cross the border is inherently a criminal. And the thing is, when you try to seek asylum by crossing the border or by showing up at the border to seek asylum, that is not inherently illegal.
Right.
It may be, it is illegal to, you know, cross the border or to overstay your visa, but legally seeking asylum, again, is legal.
Right.
And so that is what John Kelly, Kirsten Nielsen, and even Jeff Sessions are doing. They are conflating the two issues because, again, Office of Refugee Resettlement is the word is right there, refugee resettlement. And so, again, there are cases of undocumented minors and undocumented people. And again, this administration and previous administrations have deemed them criminals. But when you are legally seeking asylum, you shouldn't be conflating them with undocumented people.
Right. And you made a good point is that once you label them criminals, it's way easier to conflate them with MS-13.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's the real problem here is that Donald Trump, again, we've talked about this last week, and anytime we talk about immigration, he's stoking this fear for his base to make it seem as if he's keeping a promise and prosecuting criminals. But all he's doing is literally separating families, literally dehumanizing people. And the one thing that bothered me, and I'm sorry to get on this, but it was bothering me all on Twitter, is like a bunch of people who had good intentions were like, this is not our America, when they were talking about these parents being separated from their children. And again, you just have to take like an eighth grade history class to know that we separated enslaved people from their children for decades upon decades. This is literally the process that we used to rip them from their families in Africa and then continue to rip them from their families when they were here in the United States. So
yes, this is our America.
This is exactly like, what our America is.
Fucking deal with it.
And this is what we have been for 240 years. But what we are asking is to change that policy because this was happening. The abuse was happening. The horrible things that ICE has been doing has been happening since its inception under the Bush years and under Obama years. And it's just only getting worse under Trump. And so that's what's really important to remember is that this is not a new problem. And getting rid of Trump is not going to solve the problem.
Right.
The problem is what ICE stands for and what ICE is doing, because what ICE stands for since its inception under DHS and why it was created is to deem a bunch of people just seeking a better life in America because they believe in the values of America we don't apparently believe in as criminals,
right,
and then continue to prosecute them, continue to terrorize them, and continue to put them as criminals in front of American society.
Right.
And we've been doing that since the Bush years, and we did it a lot under Obama. It's just getting even worse under Trump.
I think there's also a misconception that ICE has this like long, deep roots.
It does not.
It does not. It is a relatively new department. And so the idea of dismantling ICE, it shouldn't be that shocking. It was created for a specific purpose. The purpose is not working. But I feel like there's this idea that once a government agency is created, there's no way to decommission it, as it were. Especially, and I've talked to a lot of people who've been like, oh, ICE has been around forever. Oh, this is how we've always dealt with immigration. Like, no, it's really, really not. And this also really goes back to this idea of what Jeff Sessions said and made this statement saying separating children is now policy, saying it's a deterrent. And John Kelly said it's a deterrent, and deterrence is the name of the game. But I have to wonder, is it actually a deterrent?
I don't think it is.
It's
because a parent or a child or whoever is facing violence in whatever area of South America they're in or in Mexico, they're coming to the United States or, you know, to another country because they are seeking safety.
Right.
And so they're not checking Twitter to figure out whether or not Donald Trump is angry at MS-13 today. They're not checking Twitter to figure out Jeff Sessions' new policy. They're running from violence.
Right.
So this is not really a deterrent because I don't think Jeff Sessions is broadcasting his policy in Spanish.
Right.
And I don't think he's telling other governments about it. I don't think that other governments are disseminating this information because these citizens are running in fear.
Right.
And
it just goes back to this idea of energizing Trump's base and throwing red meat to that segment of the voting population. And then, you know, like I said, creating this mythology around ICE, that it's somehow always been here and doing this great work. And I think that, like you said, Varsha, we're not saying that this is a new problem. We're saying this is a really old problem and we need to stop it now.
Yeah, and it comes from ICE's inception, which is just more proof that ICE itself is a flawed agency, that all it seeks to do is terrorize.
So I've talked about Framebridge before. They're a company that makes it super easy and affordable to custom frame your favorite things, from art prints and posters to the photos on your phone. So you can go to framebridge.com and upload a photo from your computer or directly from Instagram, and they will print it and have it framed. Also, if you have a physical item, they provide a secure prepaid package so you can mail it to them for free. And I did this with my Women's March poster, and I got it back, and it's absolutely beautiful. And I finally hung it up in my new office. And y'all, it looks amazing. And you can frame anything. Ticket stubs, posters. I would love someone to frame a cardboard cutout of Hillary Clinton. I mean, it would be amazing. So the expert team at Framebridge will custom frame your item in days, not weeks or months, and deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang. And the best part is that instead of the hundreds of dollars you pay at a framing store, their prices start at $39 and all shipping is free. Plus, Hellions get 15% off their first order at framebridge.com when they use code HELLBENT. And I would actually love to see stuff that you all have framed by Framebridge. Do you have a picture of you meeting Hillary Clinton? Do you have ticket stubs? Do you have your Women's March poster? I would honestly love to see it because I cannot get enough of this service. I know this is an ad, but honestly, I love it. So get started framing your photos or art today. You can go to framebridge.com and use promo code HELLBENT to save an additional 15% off your first order. That's framebridge.com, promo code HELLBENT. Framebridge.com, use promo code HELLBENT. All right, Varsha. So we don't cover a lot of foreign policy on this podcast, but I do think that what has been going on with North Korea is so important in a larger domestic context. So what happened with Trump canceling this historic meeting between North Korea? By the way, he already had challenge coins printed up, which is apparently something you do in government. When you go to like a big meeting, is you get these like weird coins printed up and they're like collector's items, but you don't print them up until you have the meeting. But the Trump administration actually printed up these coins before they had
And even advertise that they had printed,
yeah.
Which is just like, it's literally like, I don't know, it's the
arrogance.
It's arrogance. It's also the epitome of your mom saying, don't count your chickens before they hatch.
Right.
And they literally, that's what they did.
Right.
And that's what Trump has been doing since day one, though.
Right.
Because anytime he says, oh, I just did something in North Korea, which is like a small, tiny thing
right.
that other administrations have pulled off, he's like, I've accomplished this amazing thing.
Nobel Peace Prize time!
That previous presidents have not been able to do. Exactly.
Like, come on.
It was insane that I think like 12 or 14 GOP congressmen like nominated Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize last Monday or something. And then Thursday he cancels the meeting.
Come on.
Yeah, but basically.
Like such a self-own.
Yeah. And that's the news. Like President Trump, he canceled the meeting on Thursday, pulled out of the summit meeting with Kim Jong-un, which was supposed to be scheduled for June 12th in Singapore. And basically the president made this announcement through this really, really weird letter. It sounded like a letter that you would send.
An ex-lover.
Yeah, to not just an ex-lover. It sounded like a letter you would send to a person that would never date you, but you really just want to tell them I'm rejecting you before you can have a chance to reject me. And it's again, it was very, very weird because I've never seen a president conduct diplomacy like that.
Well, yeah, like hold the fuck up was my first thought. Like, since when is the U.S. all lovey-dovey with North Korea? Like, seriously, especially because it was this side of a year ago that Trump and Kim Jong-un were sending like basically dick pics to each other and comparing the size of their nuclear buttons.
And that's what was so weird about the letter. It's like half of it was lovey-dovey. It was like, it's so great talking to you.
Yeah, like you're lovely.
It was like, you know, all of this has been warm and productive. But then at the same time, he's like, I have really massive weapons, Kim Jong-un. I hope I never have to use them. Like, right. What the fuck?
Like, what are we doing here? Like, it was very confusing.
It was like a person trying to play good cop, bad cop, but like the same person. And that's not how good cop, bad cop works. And good cop, bad cop doesn't actually work. So
you've been watching too much Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Trumpy
Poo. I have.
Poo.
And I'm very happy it's been renewed. Yeah, me but too. Again, it was very... very weird. And so the White House itself seemed ill-prepared for the meeting to happen, and it was also ill-prepared for the meeting to be canceled because nobody apparently knew.
Wait, like, I just don't understand, like, how could... Okay. All right. All right. Farsha, maybe I'm missing something because I don't know a ton about foreign policy. So, you know, do you usually just set up meetings with North Korea with no, like, firm plan or agenda or outline or anything like that?
No, that's not what you do.
Oh, that's not how it works?
Yeah. Okay. So the Iran deal took almost 2 years to finish up to completion. And when it comes to other deals, such as like the, anti-nuclear deals of the Cold War, it took them years to finally decide. You know, everybody liked to compare this whole Trump going to North Korea, the summit thing, to Nixon goes to China.
Right.
The Nixon goes to China meeting took them almost 2 years to prepare for.
Right.
And all that meeting was just literally shaking hands with the leader of China.
Right.
And like getting on a plane and shaking hands.
Right.
Like, and Trump ruined whatever preparation they had done for this meeting with one letter. And apparently he didn't even tell South Korea, which I want to emphasize is our ally in this. He didn't tell South Korea that this meeting was going to be canceled because South Korea has been working, and like Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, has been like hoping for this for years now because he is the head of what we would call the Liberal Party in the U.S. So he's like the Democratic Party of South Korea. And he campaigned on actually getting to the table with South Korea and actually getting stuff done with North Korea. And the Conservative Party, again, just like the Conservative Party in the U.S., is criticizing him for doing too much, being too conciliatory. So he has a lot riding on this politically. But also the country has a lot riding on this in terms of South Korea, again, is right next to North Korea. And if...
Surprise, geography.
If anybody's like big buttons got out of hand, it's South Korea who would suffer.
Right.
And so they are very, very on edge about this. And they were very caught off guard. And basically, the tweets that came out on Thursday morning were like, South Korean government is very caught off guard. We're trying to figure out exactly what Trump means. And everybody in the U.S. is like, same.
Same. Hard same, bro. Hard same.
And so that's basically the problem here, is not just that this meeting was decided upon hastily and there was not a lot of preparation done for it. It's also that this meeting was canceled hastily and not a lot of preparation done for that. And even our allies are really frustrated. And it's not just South Korea. It's also people in Europe. GOP leaders are a little like weirded out by it. But there's also obviously GOP leaders like Mitch McConnell, who's like, yeah, this is a great thing for Trump to do. Cancel the meeting. And I'm like,
what?
Why was that a good thing, Mitch? Why was that a good thing?
Right. Well, you know, I have to wonder. So I think what I've heard and kind of been reading up on a little bit is that for Trump, if we take this in a vacuum, just Trump, okay, we take all of our allies, we take South Korea out of it. For Trump, he had nothing really to gain politically by going through with this meeting. So setting up the meeting and printing up challenge coins and nominating himself for the Nobel Peace Prize and getting his base frothing at the mouth with like, oh, he's going to do something that no other president's been able to do. And just that lead up, that frenzy, that was politically a win for him.
That was the win because right. He knows no matter how dumb we all may think he is, he knows deep down that he's not going to get something every other president has failed to do
right.
Since so the 1990s.
He has to make it a PR issue.
He has to make it a PR issue because I think he was pretty sure as soon as John Bolton went on TV and said this might be like the Libya model, he was pretty sure he's not going to get North Korea to denuclearize.
Right.
And that is the fundamental thing about North Korea, that no conservative who's been praising Trump about this North Korea thing, Secretary Pompeo, that John Bolton don't seem to understand, is that North Korea is not like Iran, is not like Libya. It does not want to give up its nuclear weapons.
Right.
And so basically, this is a great piece by Zach Beauchamp at Vox. And he basically had this line, which I really agree with. So, quote, setting aside the Trump administration's handling of this high stakes diplomatic wrangling, there's a fundamental flaw with America's approach to North Korea that preceded Trump. This has been a problem since way before Trump. Quote, that's the fantasy that the U.S. can somehow convince North Korea to voluntarily give up its nukes. The reason North Korea won't do that is because North Korea's history with America is based in fear.
Right.
After the Korean War, the reason the Korean War was fought to a draw is because America came in support of South Korea. And since then, we've stood in support of South Korea, saying, if anybody attacks South Korea, we will attack them.
Right.
And so North Korea since then has built its identity around fear and opposition to America.
Right.
And that is why it developed nuclear weapons in the first place. So this notion that we can somehow convince Kim Jong-un to give up his nuclear weapons based on, I think what Donald Trump said is, we'll make him very happy, we'll protect him a lot. What can be more protective than nuclear weapons?
Right, right. Like, what kind of protections are we offering? And especially because, again, a key player in this that we haven't really talked much about yet is China. And really, China, who is the main trade partner with North Korea, if China doesn't go along with this, then the U.S. has no negotiating power. Has no standing, right? Because currently the U.S. doesn't do trade with North Korea of any kind. So they have no real, I mean, they can say, okay, well, we'll allow U.S. companies to work with North Korea, and that could potentially lead to an economic boon. But again, we're talking about a lot of like eventualities and maybes. And again, for Trump politically in a vacuum, him actually taking this meeting was not the political win. Him doing this whole PR campaign around it was the political win. And then therefore him canceling it, he really lost no political capital. Because of all of this, because of this history, no one really thought this meeting was going to happen. And so by him canceling it, like you said, Varsha, it does sound a lot like someone who's like, I really want to date you, but I know you don't want to date me, so I'm going to reject you first.
That's basically what happened. And so it all comes back to China, that you're right. Because China, I think, I don't know at what point this was agreed upon, but the Trump administration did get China, or at least Donald Trump tweeted about it a lot, is that China was increasing sanctions on North Korea a little bit. But because Trump pulled out of this meeting, China may relaxed pressure on North Korea again. And so
right.
It has no incentive to continue maximum pressure if Donald Trump is going to ruin weeks or months of planning and basically like reject this meeting. And I know this meeting, you know, was going to be a disaster on any front because Donald Trump is president. People just keep forgetting that. But the fact that Donald Trump can't even stick with the meeting that he managed to get, which, again, is a pretty good get. So the reason it's a good get is because every other president has been asked for this meeting. North Korea has asked every other president for a meeting like this for international recognition as a state. But every other president has said no, because that's what North Korea wants, is recognition as a state.
Right. Well, and so not to jump back into the toddler metaphor fray here, but what I will say is that the first thing you learn as a parent is that you have to be consistent.
Exactly.
So something like this where China, you know, it puts more sanctions on North Korea, but then pulls them off as soon as the U.S. backs away. Like once you give something, you can't really take it back. When you're setting up a relationship, you have to be consistent in what you're going to do.
Exactly.
And so this lack of consistency, and I'm not calling anyone toddlers here, but what I am saying is that when you have to stand firm on what you say, you have to follow through.
And that is the problem with Donald Trump's diplomacy, is that he sees it as like a transactional thing that can happen over a couple of weeks or at most a couple of months. But again, that's not how diplomacy works. As we probably know from our history books, it takes years to actually set up a meeting and then to execute that meeting and then finally to get an agreement. So this notion that he could have solved a problem that has eluded every single president in a matter of months was bananas to begin with. And we really shouldn't be surprised that he ruined it in a matter of days with a letter. But we should be worried, because the thing is, we're not supposed to be rooting for Donald Trump to fail at this, because again, he is armed with nuclear weapons, but we should be worried that he doesn't really seem to
grasp
the idea that it could have been a big win for him if he had just like stuck with the meeting.
Right.
Because even though he wouldn't have like succeeded at anything, you don't know what John Bolton or Secretary Pompeo could have pulled out of this, because they did manage to get, you know, they did manage to get political prisoners out of North Korea, three of them. There were some concessions North Korea was making. And what's really scary about this, and the real reason I'm afraid of Donald Trump and his diplomacy, is because the day this letter came out, there were still journalists in North Korea watching North Korea dismantle one of its nuclear facilities. And that's one of the biggest concessions North Korea has given. I'm not saying it was enough for us to keep in this meeting. I'm not saying it's enough to believe North Korea's good faith or to believe North Korea wants to denuclearize.
But there were American journalists there.
There were journalists there. And that is dangerous. That is literally like leaving journalists in the lion's mouth while, you know, while off doing something else. Like,
right.
It's so... it was so incompetent. And I think that's what's really frustrating and what's keeping everybody on the edge of their seats, is that the incompetence is just really
staggering.
Bad. Staggering. It's staggering, yeah. Because...
Well, and then to continue the incompetence theme. So on Sunday, there is now like reportedly a frantic behind the scenes effort to resurrect this meeting. Still on the June 12th date, which I don't know if you guys know, but June 12th is in like 2 minutes. I mean, it's right around the corner. And like you said, this shit takes fucking years.
Also, the only reason Donald Trump really wants to resurrect this meeting is because he's mad that the New York Times reported that people on background said, oh, yeah, the meeting's off the books. Right. Basically, as soon as Donald Trump released the letter right on Thursday, I think there was a background report or something, or somebody went on background in the White House to talk about how, oh, yeah, it was going to be tough for us to get this meeting back on board anyway. It's probably never going to be on board. It's probably done, right? And then Donald Trump said on Saturday or something, hey, the failing New York Times, quote, used a fake source. This source never doesn't even exist. And everyone was like, who are you going to believe, you or your lying eyes? Like, it made no sense, because right. These reporters were in the room with this background source who said this meeting is totally off.
Right.
Right. And so that is another compounded reason. This is, like, I think Donald Trump is forcing people to get this meeting back on track because of his ego.
Right. Well, that's all. I mean, yeah, that's basically the tagline of this entire presidency, because of my ego. And it's just, it's frustrating, because this, like, all of these things we're talking about, ICE and immigration and North Korea, and these are all fucking with people's lives. Like, we're fucking with people's lives here. And the fact that Trump has no regard for that whatsoever, and the entire Trump administration has no regard for that whatsoever, really speaks volumes as to the type of leadership that he is presenting. And I think if nothing else happens, when the history books look back on this, it's going to be a dark spot in American history, if only because we gave up the compassionate leadership that we at least pretend to have.
Yeah, and not just compassionate leadership, which, again, is so essential, but also competent leadership.
Right.
Because, you know, bringing back this meeting, it could mean that North Korea could ask for something that the U.S. under any other president would not give.
Right.
Such as dismantling of certain nuclear weapons or certain defenses. And so that's what's really frustrating about this, is because Donald Trump doesn't know what he can and cannot say yes to.
Right.
Because right, he's so eager for a deal.
Right. And theoretically, he can say yes or no to anything. He's the president.
Exactly.
So he could give something up that's not his to give.
Exactly. And that's why it's really frustrating.
This Friday is National Gun Violence Awareness Day and the start of Wear Orange Weekend, and people around the country are coming together with a simple message: there's more we can do to end gun violence. Orange is the defining color of the gun violence prevention movement. Show your support by wearing orange on Friday, I know I will, and post a picture using the hashtag WearOrange. Every year, Every Town for Gun Safety and a broad coalition of partners call on Americans to wear orange for National Gun Violence Awareness Day, both to honor the more than 90 lives cut short and the hundreds more wounded by gun violence every day, to demand action towards a future free from gun violence. Join the movement by wearing orange this Friday, June 1st, and don't forget to post your pictures online using the hashtag WearOrange to show the world you're committed to ending gun violence in every community. Also, the Hellbent accounts will be monitoring this, and we will be sharing people who use the hashtag as well. You could go to Everytown's website at everytown.org to find an event for Wear Orange Weekend of Action. Together, we can stand up, speak out, and wear orange to raise awareness about gun violence. All right, Varsha, so let's get into some gratitude. So what are you grateful for today?
I think what I'm really grateful for today is my upcoming trip to DC. I'm actually going to be spending the next 8 weeks in DC doing a lot of research, doing a lot of writing, and it's going to be a lot of fun because my first time living in a different city besides Berkeley for the past 5 years. So I'm very excited to stay in DC. I was in DC in January, so I'm very excited to stay there for a little bit longer, really get to know the museums, you know, fall in love with the place all over again, because I really like DC. And so that's what I'm grateful for. I'm also grateful for the fact that DC not only has the great museums like the National Portrait Gallery with Barack Obama and Michelle Obama's portraits, but last time I was there, I got to see the U.S. Constitution, and I want to see that again when I go back. So it's like the room gives you chills. You can't take any pictures, but it's a great place to go. I just really like it.
You are my favorite nerd I've ever met. That's my favorite thing. Yeah, that's really great. I love that. Well, today I am grateful because it's actually Hank's, my son's, fourth birthday today.
Oh, that's so great.
It is his fourth birthday, and it's really great. It's also very sweet because Alex and Hank have started a tradition for me on Hank's birthday where they get me a card and me a little present because it was a big day for me too, as they say. And Alex calls it was the birth of you as a mom.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So it's like my birthday too. And so, you know, they got me like flowers and this little card, and in the card this year, Alex wrote basically, you know, I hope that as Hank gets older, he starts to use this as a way to recognize female work and female pain as it relates to him and his life. And I was like,
that's so amazing.
I love you. Yeah. And so that's just really wonderful. And I'm excited. And we're going to have a big birthday party for him on Sunday. And Batman's coming. And
oh, yeah.
Everyone's very excited for Batman.
Everyone's very excited for Batman.
And then also, I really loved in the Dick Wads Be Gone Facebook group, there's this great thread that someone started asking about feminist books for little boys. Mm-hmm. And it's been giving me a lot of great suggestions. And so I actually bought a bunch of books for him for his birthday that have like more feminist themes and showing boys in more, you know, feminist roles. And I think it's just really great. And I just love, you know, again, this week it's his birthday. And so I've just really loved the sort of the parent support, especially in this community, and you know, raising feminist kids and that has been really, really great. So,
yeah, that's awesome. Congratulations to Hank.
Yeah.
Four is a big year.
Four is a big year.
Yeah.
All right, Varsha. So next up, we have Dickwad of the Week.
Yeah, and we're keeping up with the Trump theme.
Seriously.
This time, we've nominated Ivanka Trump.
Yes.
And basically, Ivanka Trump, because she is in the middle of a lot of grift going on in the White House.
She really is.
And the thing is, people like give her a pass because, I don't know, she's pretty or something and blonde. And it's very frustrating that people give her a pass because I actually think it's actually sexist because they're saying because she's pretty and blonde and just a mom or whatever and ignorant or whatever, she doesn't have agency to commit crime.
Right.
But she does. And the reason she does is recently, which was just reported yesterday, China gave Ivanka Trump 7 new trademarks. And basically, trademarks are a way to prevent other people from making money off of your name. But it takes a long time to get these trademarks in China. A long, long time. And magically, Donald Trump and Ivanka Trump and a lot of the other Trumps have managed to get trademarks in record time since they've ascended the presidency.
What? Must be such coincidence.
I know. And that basically, that's what the New York Times was like, coincidence?
Yeah.
Probably. And I'm like, really, New York Times? Maybe it wasn't a coincidence.
Okay. First of all, there are no coincidences in war or politics. There's just not.
I can't see it as a coincidence. It just does not make sense. I don't think anything happens in China as a coincidence.
Right. Well, because around the same time, this is when Trump has intervened and is trying to find a way to save basically a major Chinese telecommunications company from going under. So this communications company is called ZTE, and they have actually violated a few sanctions the U.S. had imposed on them. And as a result, their business is in peril. And so now, but Trump has said, okay, well, we need to step in and make sure they don't go bust.
Basically, a couple of weeks ago, Donald Trump tweeted, there's so many jobs being lost in China as a result of this ZTE problem. And I'm just like, wait a second, what happened to the America First president? I'm not saying that America First is a good slogan. Obviously, it harkens back to Nazi propaganda in the 1930s in America. But at the same time, why is he suddenly obsessed with ZTE? And the reason could be that there is some sort of quid pro quo. And the quid pro quo could be two things. One, he could be expecting China to put more pressure on North Korea.
Right.
And that's fair. But also, how much are you giving up by helping this company?
Right.
Right? And another thing could be he's helping China or helping this company to get something back personally from China. And that could be these trademarks, because it's not just Ivanka Trump who got these trademarks. It's also Donald Trump has gotten more than 100 trademarks in China over the past few years. But senators are talking about how these trademarks actually could be a violation of like emoluments clauses.
Right. And this is why everyone and their mother is Googling emoluments clause when no one knew what the fuck it was before 2017. I mean, it's really, again, and this may be my like tinfoil hat hair coming out a little bit, but I don't believe in coincidences when it comes to this kind of stuff. There's no way that Trump has just decided to step in out of the goodness of his heart to help ZTE at the same time. His daughter's getting trademarks approved. He's getting trademarks approved. And I, you know, there could be a component with North Korea, and I'm not discounting that. But a lot of, you know, being president and an administration, even the appearance of impropriety is enough to, it's why Carter had to sell his goddamn peanut farm.
This is what really, really bothers me, is because Ivanka Trump, again, because of her image or whatever, because she's seen as this bullshit moderating force on Donald Trump, even though she isn't, she gets a pass on all of this. And that's why she's the dickwad this week, because she has 34 trademarks in China now. And that's going to allow her brand to compete really well in like the world's second largest economy while she's working for our government. Right. I don't care if she's just volunteering for our government, because apparently she doesn't get a paycheck. She's still in the White House. Right. She's still representing our government. She goes to meetings and represents the president, like as if she, like, it wouldn't it be really weird if like, you know, Barack Obama sent Malia Obama to a NATO meeting?
Right.
Basically, that's what's been happening with Ivanka Trump. And right. So she gets to have her cake and eat it too, represent the United States government as like a policy leader, and at the same time make a shitload of money.
Right.
And that is why she's a dickwad, is because she is at the center of all of this grift and corruption, and she's just so lacking in self-awareness.
Right.
And there's another reason she's lacking in self-awareness.
To that point, bonus round, she's also the dickwad because on Sunday, she tweeted a picture of her cuddling her 2-year-old son, Theodore. At the same time, widespread news reports detailed children being taken away from their mothers by U.S. border agents. This is from The Guardian. I don't understand how you can be so unaware to know what is being reported on a place where you work. I don't care if you're a volunteer or not. She works in the White House. Her father's the president of the United States. She has to know what's being reported. And the reporting is that children are being taken away from the mothers at the border. And so she then goes and posts a picture of herself with her 2-year-old son all lovey-dovey.
And I'm just like, I understand that, you know, you could argue maybe you didn't pay attention to the news. But the thing is, your own father blamed the Democrats about this policy like a couple hours ago.
Right.
And so you're posting this picture when you God well know what your father is tweeting about. So I don't understand how you could be so lacking in self-awareness. And it's really, really, it's like the let them eat cake of the 21st century.
It is, absolutely. I was just going to say.
And I mean, I know it's been like there's disputing reports historically whether or not Marie Antoinette really said that, but Ivanka Trump really did that.
Yeah.
She really posted that photo, and it's happened a lot. I think last year there was a huge crisis in Syria. I think it was right after the gassing attacks or something. And she posted a picture of her and Jared Kushner going to this ball all dressed up. She's done it a bunch of times.
Right.
And she is like our own Marie Antoinette in the United States, because for some reason, like, you know, Melania has been missing for the past 14 days.
Right.
So it's very, very embarrassing to have her represent us at all of these international meetings and at the same time have so little care for the U.S. public.
Right. Well, and there's also been people saying, oh, she's allowed to post what she wants, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, she doesn't. That's part of the contract. When someone becomes president of the United States and their families, it's a decision, has to be a family decision, because no, now what you post is for public consumption and represents us as a country.
You became a public figure. You chose that life.
Right.
And you could have just stayed in New York and worked at your company and not even talked about government issues, all that stuff, as Donald Trump Jr. is pretending to do, even though he's not.
Right.
You could have done that. But you chose to move to D.C. with your husband and work in the White House and help your father. And so, therefore, you should be responsible for what you put out in the world.
Absolutely.
And so even though it was just a picture of you and your son, you should know what is going on in the world. And that's another reason why it's so embarrassing and why she's a dickwad, is because the level of ignorance it must take to post that photo.
Yeah. And even if it's not ignorance, even if she knows, it might be worse, because then she just doesn't care.
Okay, Devin, so what are some action items for our listeners this week?
Okay, so first one pertains to the ICE and immigration story we talked about. At Amanda Littman on Twitter said, quote, our pals at ActBlue have put together a page where you can give immediately to a bunch of groups working to help kids separated from their families by ICE. It's not nearly enough, but it's a start. So you can go to secure.actblue.com/donate/kids-at-the-border, and you can give and it'll go directly to groups that are working to solve that problem. Also, you need to call your reps about this issue. Immigration, a DACA fix, these are all things that can and must be done at a legislative level.
Yeah, and the reason that you really should call your reps is because Marco Rubio and a bunch of other GOP senators are like, oh yeah, we're open to changing the law that separates kids from their parents. There is no law.
Right.
It's not a law.
It's not a law.
The only reason it's happening is because Jeff Sessions made it a policy.
Right.
Jeff Sessions and John Kelly have interpreted the law this way.
Right.
But it's not a law.
Right.
It's really necessary that we keep our eyes on this because this administration is hurting people every day. And I think since the DACA bill failed, a few months ago after the government shutdown, we've sort of lost track of this. And I am really horrified that this is the reason we're paying attention again, but we really should be, and we should be telling our representatives about it.
Yeah. Well, this actually, yes, they should be on your seat ballot. This is actually to Drexel's credit, because he called it back when we were talking about this earlier this year, and he was like, this is an issue that's really easy to take your eye off of, right? It's really easy to get fired up about it when there's a bill and then the bill fails or doesn't fail, but then nothing happens.
Because the same thing happened with the Muslim ban.
Absolutely.
The first Muslim ban, it was January 30th or whatever. It was way like the early days of the Trump administration. Everyone was angry. We were angry for days. We continued being angry. And then 100,000 or some, a huge number of people watched or listened to the Ninth Circuit's recording of
right.
their case, literally live. It's the most they've ever heard. But then we all forgot about it when the second Muslim ban came around, and then the third one, and now the third one's Supreme Court, and barely anyone's paying attention to it.
Right. So this is definitely something we need to keep an eye on. Also, vote. We are going to vote. So June 4th, the Connecticut House of Representatives District 4 has a special election. On June 5th, Missouri State Senate District 17 has a special election. Those are both general elections. And also on June 5th are primaries in California, Iowa, Mississippi, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, and South Dakota.
And these primaries are really important, especially in California, but I mean, obviously elsewhere, but especially in California, because there are certain districts in California where if we don't get enough voters, the top two candidates might end up being Republican.
Right.
And because we have a jungle primary system, that's horrific. And there was this great piece in, I think, Progress. I apologize to any listener who out there is a Gavin Newsom fan, but there was like a great piece in Think Progress about this, about how Gavin Newsom is sort of encouraging Republican voters to come out because he wants Archibald or whatever his name is, Cox, to be his opponent in the gubernatorial race.
Right.
But what that could do is have a down ballot effect on these House races.
Right.
So again, I mean, I'm not blaming Gavin Newsom or taking blame away from him on that, whatever you think you can think. But what that means for us practically is that we have to go out there and vote.
Right.
I've already sent him in a ballot. I mean, obviously my ballot doesn't matter because Barbara Lee is going to win and she's awesome. But if you live in a district that does matter,
right.
you have to vote. And you must get a bunch of your friends to vote. They all have to vote.
Absolutely. I'm going to do this in the style of the Great British Bake Off that I'm watching a lot of, where they go, on your mark, get set, vote. All right. Well, that does it for us today. This was a great... Marcia, this is amazing.
This is a lot of
fun. Oh my God, we have to, I wish you could be here all the time in person.
This is a lot of fun.
This is great. Well, thank you for listening. Thank you for coming by, Marcia. And I will be back here on Thursday with a very special guest. So raise some hell and remember to be kind.